Accession number 29054, Mr. Bim Wells, Reel 10. Now, you were just approaching. Now, were there any signs? We were just approaching Tokushima Airfield at Honshu Island on the 24th of July 1945. Now, as you approached, was there any sign of Japanese fighters or anti-aircraft fire? What was happening?
No sign of any fighters, but as we got nearer to the airfield, we suddenly experienced flak. And it was pretty accurate, you know. I can remember our formation sort of wavered a bit because they'd more or less got the height of our flight very accurately. And suddenly there were puffs of anti-aircraft fire exploding round our flight. And that was the first time I'd really experienced flak of that density, and it was quite dense. And
did you fly straight or did you manoeuvre? What did you do? Or what did the
We continued to fly in formation, but as I say, when these flak bursts started exploding around us, there was a little bit of wavering in the formation, but we joined up again, and then we were given the order by our flight leader to go into line astern, so you get in line astern behind the leader prior to doing the dive bombing attack on the airfield. And he again gave the order that he was start commencing his dive, and he sort of peeled off and went into his dive, and I followed about 5 seconds later.
Now, what was dive bombing like? What do you remember of it? Well, on that day?
Yeah, we'd done an awful lot of practice dive bombing with smoke bombs and this sort of thing, but this was the real thing. And I concentrated my dive on a what appeared to be a barrack block at the side of the airfield, and that was my aiming point, and I went into my dive and dropped all my 4 bombs in one cluster, and my air gunner said that 2 of the bombs had hit this barrack block. Because I pulled out, the thing to do then was to get the hell out of there as quick as you could.
What height would you drop the bombs from, approximately? And I know you can't possibly know, really.
Well, I think we started our dive at about 3,000 feet, and we released them at about 500 feet, and you then pull out of the dive and...
Was there any ground fire from machine gun, you know, lighter
flak?
Well,
there was, yes. In fact, a number of the aircraft in the squadron did get back to the ship with holes in the fuselage, holes in the wings. Particularly on that strike, I haven't got any holes in my aircraft anyway. But of course, we then had to get to this rendezvous point because, as you probably realise, that the Japanese were, we reached the rendezvous point, and all the aircraft in my flight were there, and of course the main reason that we had to join up in a formation again to get back to the fleet was because they were expecting kamikaze attacks on the fleet, and it was no good heading back to the fleet in the form of single aircraft. We had to go back in formation so that the fleet gunners would realise that we were, as it were, friendly aircraft and not kamikaze attacks. And the other main reason was, of course, that I had got no observer, and unless I got back into the formation, my chances of finding the fleet, I wouldn't say they were impossible, but it was a bit difficult. We did have a homing beacon on the Implacable and all the other carriers, which was...
How did that work?
Well, it was a circular thing split into about 12 sections, and in each section was a letter of the alphabet. And you could pick this up about 60 miles away from the ship, and you switched this piece of equipment on, and you would pick up a Morse code letter, and you'd look at your circular dial and think, well, I'm in that sector. So you carry on flying in that sector, and you then get into another letter, and you then realise you've either got to turn left or right to get back to the ship. Obviously, for security reasons, these letter codes were changed every single day or every single time you went on a strike, because there was a danger that the Japanese would pick these up as well, you see. So it was for that reason, it was done in that way. Anyway, we got back to the Implacable, and we landed on, and we were then debriefed.
Anything about the debriefing?
Well, there were a number of debriefing officers, and different crews went to different officers, and you were asked to record your details of how the strike went, what you did, where you dropped your bombs, and this, that, and the other, and it was all recorded in that way. The actual time it took from taking off the carrier to getting back was about 3.25 hours.
So it's about an hour and a half each way. How many miles? And what, 150 or?
I was something over 100 miles, I would think. The Avenger was not really a fast aircraft compared with some of these things, and you had to, you didn't go flat out, you went at a cruising speed to get there. But so I would think it was round about 100 to 120 miles away from when we took off to get to this airfield, and then, as I say, there was a journey up and getting back on. The following day,
the 25th,
we did a second strike on Tokushima Airfield. I think I said it was on Honshu. I think, in fact, it was not on Honshu, but Shikoku, which is another of the islands.
I'll correct that. They can look at the notes.
I'm pretty sure. I've got here Shikoku, and that's, I think, where it was.
How do you spell that? I'm not sure.
S-H-I-K... OKU.
So as it
Shikoku,
sounds.
Shikoku, yeah.
So what about this? So this was the next day. Now, obviously, I don't want to... What do you remember of that strike that was different, or what do you remember anything about that?
It was more or less the same format, but I think the flak was even greater on the second strike. In fact... I made a note in my logbook that three of the planes in our squadron were hit by flak. We didn't actually lose any of them, but they were again hit by you know like bigger holes in the airframe.
You've not mentioned any sign of fighters yet, or Japanese fighters. Were they just not about?
Well, if they were, they didn't get very close to us. I think our fighter cover were extremely good, the Sea Fires, and if anybody did start approaching the squadron, I never actually saw a Japanese fighter, I've got to be quite honest, and I'm pleased I didn't, really. But
what did you target this time? It was Barrack Block the first time. What was the state of the airfield, and what did you target with this run, if you can remember? I know it's...
Well, there was still smoke coming up from the various buildings and so on from the previous day's strike. And we were told to attack anything that looked like aircraft on the ground. Of course, what you can't discern when you're on a dive bombing run is whether the aircraft are dummies or whether they are actual real aircraft, but we were asked to concentrate our attacks on anything that looked like Japanese aircraft.
Did you see anything? Were you able to bomb any aircraft?
We did see some. As I say, the difficulty was knowing whether they were real or dummies. But I certainly dropped my bombs towards a couple of aircraft that were fairly close together. And
did your gunner tell you whether you'd hit, or are you not sure?
He was busy himself, he said, because he was firing his guns on this thing. He was having a go at the anti-aircraft guns that he could see firing, and he said I was really busy having a go at them. I didn't really see what happened to your bombs, but. As I say, that I do remember the flak being rather more concentrated on that second strike.
Any trouble with the rendezvous?
No, it all went very well. And then, what, 3 days later, we went on another strike.
So this would be, what, the 28th?
28th. This was on shipping. Mainly merchant shipping. We were informed there may be one or two Japanese naval ships, but this was at a place called Harima Bay, and this was on the island of Honshu.
And Harima's, as it sounds, H-A-R-I-M-A?
Yes, it is. Harima Bay on Honshu.
Now, what do you remember of that? The 28th.
I remember, again, we flew in formation, and I could see the shipyard, and there were a number of like bays with ships in them, and that is what we were detailed to attack by our flight leader, who again was Clifford Wearden. And the routine was very much the same: get in line astern, go into your dive, and I did, my air gunner said, I did, one of my bombs did land on one of these ships towards the stern of it, and I did make a note in my logbook that we had good results on this strike. Two days later, we were on another strike on another airfield, again on Honshu. This airfield was called Suzuka, S-U-Z-U-K-A. The problem on this strike was when we got to the Japanese coast, it was completely enveloped in 10/10 cloud. And we, in fact, were ordered by Lieutenant Commander Swanton, our CO, to jettison our bombs either over the land or over the sea, because it was too dangerous to land on the deck with primed bombs, and so the bombs were actually jettisoned. So,
and the cloud, it was low cloud, was it?
It was called, you call it 10/10 cloud. It was like, if you know anything about cloud formation, stratus is the type of cloud it was, which is this low grey cloud with no breaks in it at all. And so they were our instructions, that, and we obviously tried to find this place because the duration of the flight was 3.5 hours. So we'd in fact,
that's the 30th, that,
yeah,
that.
We'd carried out 4 strikes in 6 days, and of course, what used to happen then is this was the pattern of the British Pacific Fleet and the American fleets. In that 4 or 6 days, you had expended a lot of ammunition, bombs, aviation fuel, and ship's fuel as well. And so we then had to retire back to meet what was called the fleet train. Now, this was stationed probably about 200, 250 miles back from the Japanese coast, and it consisted of an enormous fleet of light fleet carriers, tankers, cargo ships, and we rendezvoused with this fleet train, and the first thing that used to happen was a tanker had come alongside and they'd get this pipe over onto the Implacable and pass fuel for the ship's engines over, then pass aviation fuel for the aircraft. Then another merchant ship had come alongside with supplies of food and all the other toilet rolls, you name it, and they were all passed over. And if we'd lost any aircraft, either by ditching or being shot down or what, then they were flown off from one of these light fleet carriers that were part of this fleet train, as it was called. I mean, it was an enormous operation, as you can well imagine, that you'd go in and do these strikes, go back, replenish with supplies and fuel and aircraft and crews if necessary, then go back in again. And that was the first series of strikes we did between the 24th and the 30th of July.
Now, how long did the resupply process take? I mean, what, you know, that would start...
Well,
roughly.
It would take 4 or 5 days, that's all.
Now, were you ever attacked during this phase by any Japanese aircraft? I don't mean you, I mean the ship.
There were red alerts on 3 or 4 occasions.
And now, when were they? What were these red alerts?
The red alert was that we were attacked by bandits, as they called it, Japanese aircraft. And they were mainly the kamikaze type. What they used to do, actually, was the... The kamikaze aircraft were led in towards the fleet by, as it were, fairly experienced Japanese pilots, because the kamikaze people were basically just flying a human bomb, really. And they used to come in at a very low level, and then the leaders of these things would pull up into a higher altitude and get picked up by the fleet's radar, and they would then issue the red alert, and they tended to look at the aircraft that had pulled up high, who were these as it were the leaders, and the real kamikaze boys came in more or less at sea level. And so they weren't picked up by the radar until they were fairly close to the fleet.
Now, were there any actual attacks on your ship that you recall?
I saw a Japanese aircraft hitting the sea, but it was some miles away from us, and our ship was never, in fact, hit by a kamikaze.
Did you see them attack other ships? I mean, were the ships that were with you attacked? Do you see what I mean?
Yes, some of the other ships in the fleet were attacked, and I think some of them did suffer hits, although I can't give you any details because I don't really know.
Now, so after the resupply, I mean, was that a chance for you to get some? Was it tiring? I mean, the impact of sort of, what was it, 4 or 5 raids in 6 days, did that tire you out or emotionally or mentally or physically?
Well, yes, yes. I don't think I was aware of it at the time, quite honestly. But you know, you were on this ship. There was nowhere else to go. You couldn't go down to the village pub and have a drink and relax and see a girl or something. You were at sea. In fact, I think from the time we left Marnus for that last time to join the British Pacific Fleet, which was towards the end of June, we were at sea for, I think, 6 or 7 weeks without touching land. All we did was do the strikes, go back, meet the fleet train, replenish with supplies, go in again, strikes, and that was the pattern. It was fairly concentrated. And bear in mind that these three American groups on our left were doing similar things further down the Japanese coast. They wouldn't let us go anywhere near Tokyo because that was their territory, and they wanted their revenge for Pearl Harbor, and you know, we understood that. But so we were given these targets further up the coast than they were attacking, but it was fairly concentrated.
When you were back on the ship, did you get nervous? I mean, you know, worrying about the next raid or strike, right?
I can't honestly say I did at that time. I suppose we were young, and you know, you did these things, and you'd been trained to do it, and that was it. I think later, when I got back to Australia, I started to feel the effects then.
We'll talk about that. Right. Yeah. So you've gone back, you've been resupplied. This is very early August, from the sound of it. First 3 or 4 days of August.
Yeah. The next strike I've got in my logbook was a strike on shipping and installations at a place called Kessanuma.
K-E-S-S-E-N-N-U-M-A. That's another port.
Yeah.
And what do you remember of that? What date was that, sorry?
That was on the 9th of August.
Anything happen?
Well, I think if my memory serves me right, they had dropped on the 6th of August the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. I can remember there was a thing on the ship's notice board saying that the Americans had dropped this new type of bomb on Hiroshima, which was equivalent to 20,000 tons of TNT. And my first reaction was, oh, what the hell is that? 20,000 tons of TNT? I knew nothing about splitting atoms and so on. And I just could not picture in my mind what this bomb was that was equivalent to 20,000 tons of TNT. There was a lot of discussion went on in the boardroom, and one or two of the people who had sort of scientific experience before they went in the Navy did suggest it may be something to do with splitting the atom, but whether, you know, it was the atom bomb, they didn't really know. It was just saying 20,000 tons of TNT. So anyway,
if it was on the 6th, I'm not sure when they dropped the other bomb.
They dropped it 2 days later on the 8th.
On the 8th.
On Nagasaki. But we meantime, on the 9th of August, did this strike on Kessanuma. And the following day, we did another one in a place called Onagawa 1.
Now, what happened in the strike on the shipping at and port of Kessanuma?
I can't. It's not very clear in my mind on this particular one. It was the same pattern, you know. I remember after the raid, I did do a sweep over the harbour, and I had my 2.5 guns firing away at junks and anything else I could see. I was down to about, you know, 50 feet and just firing as I went along. And that again, that was nearly 4 hours, because the one on Kessanuma was nearly 4 hours, and the one in Onagawa
one.
Now,
what was the one next day?
One is Japanese for bay, I think. WAN is the Japanese. It's the.
I didn't get that.
It's like an inland sea. This Onagawa one was.
And how do you spell the Onagawa bit? Sorry.
O-N-A. G-A-W-A, Onagawa 1, W-A-N.
And what, this was again on shipping, was it?
Yes, a strike on shipping, yeah.
And what do you remember of that one, on Onagawa 1, sorry?
Well, again, I remember it was a harbour with ships alongside jetties. And again, we the familiar pattern, going into a dive and dropping bombs on the shipping.
But nothing special?
Nothing special, no. 2 days later, on the 12th of August, the majority of the British Pacific Fleet was ordered back to Australia. Because although the Japanese had not actually surrendered at that time, A, it was imminent, and B, we were extremely short of fuel for the ship and the aircraft, and it was either a question of going back again and meeting up with the fleet train, or as I say, the orders were to go back to Sydney, apart from the Indefatigable. And by this time, the battleship Duke of York had come up to join the fleet to relieve the King George V battleship. And those two ships with, I think, the odd cruiser were left there, and they were the ships that attended the Japanese surrender in Tokyo Bay, which I think was on the 15th of August.
So you'd be on your way back?
We were on our way back, and I know I flew from the ship to a place called Pitiloo, which again was...
Now, hang on. While you were on the ship, did you have VJ Day on the ship then?
As we steamed south, the order came from... the Admiral, who was a chap named Rawlings, to splice the main brace, which is where everybody gets, well, all the ratings who are on the rum ration get a double ration, and it's the only time that officers are allowed to have a rum ration. And I remember myself and several of the other pilots and, well, there weren't many observers, mainly pilots, went down to the air gunner's mess, and they got bottles and bottles of this, what we call pusser's rum, and it's a bit like treacle, really. It's amazingly strong, and I know I had three or four of these, and I was just about legless, I think. You know, all the sort of tension is suddenly coming out of you, I think, at this stage, and you think, Christ, it's over, you know.
You were pleased then?
I was pleased. I mean, when I found out about the atom bomb, which was... we had got some more news about it at this time, and the fact that this this B-29 Enola Gay was involved in dropping that first bomb on Hiroshima. And we were given a bit more information about this mushroom cloud and all this sort of thing. But... I mean, I think my thoughts were I thought it's a terrible weapon, but my God, it saved our lives, because there's no doubt that I don't think any of my squadron have survived to this day would have come back from that. You know, it was so concentrated, and the Japanese were so fanatical, and I think would have defended their islands to the last man, you know. And the effects of that bomb were horrific, but at the same time, I think there would have been American, British, Japanese casualties of well over a million if they'd have gone ahead with the planned invasion, which I know was already planned to take place in February of 46, and there is a name for it which I can't remember, but I was just glad that I was out of it. I mean, my part in the war was not very big, but at least I felt I'd repaid all the cost of the intensive training that I'd gone through from when I first started, and I had done my little bit towards the war at the end of it all.